listen to the Rogue Startups Podcast, where two startup founders are sharing lessons learned and pitfalls to avoid in their online businesses. And now, here's Dave and Craig.
All right, welcome back to Rogue Startups. This is episode 151. Dave, how are you doing this week?
I'm doing great. How about you, Craig?
Man, I'm doing good. I'm doing good. We've switched the day we're podcasting on. We're podcasting like Thursday evening, my time, Thursday, kind of midday your time. And I don't know, it's really nice for me because like get the week behind me for the most part. It's been really nice. I find myself kind of reflecting during our podcasting a little more than before. It was Tuesday and it's like in the middle of the week and everything is all hectic and stuff. So I'm digging it. So I hope that comes out to everybody.
I definitely am liking the switch to Thursdays. My Tuesdays were getting a little bit crazy when we were trying to do that because it's always so early in the week and then there's a bunch of stuff. I used to think that Mondays would be so bad, but then like everybody's catching up on stuff on Mondays and it kind of builds and it's like early Tuesday when all the shit that piled up over the weekend suddenly generates real work on Tuesday. Yeah. And so I feel like we've been scrambling quite a bit on Tuesdays because there's always that going on in the background. And then it's like, oh crap, it's time to do Rogue Startups. Ah. So there you go. Some behind the scenes.
That's how the sausage is made right there. That's right.
Yeah. You don't want to see the sausage being made here. It's just ugly.
Yeah, so this week we're going to kind of skip our normal updates, I think, and talk through, I think we have about 15 different topics or things that we've learned here in 2018. So Thanksgiving is next week. This will come out the Monday of the week of Thanksgiving in the U.S. So kind of getting ready and mentally for like the end of the year already. So I thought we would have like a pre-end of the year bit of reflection of things, Dave, that you and I have kind of learned or run into and maybe you want to pass on to folks, or maybe just kind of to think about and kind of pontificate on. So Dave, you want to get started with the first one?
Yeah, sure. So I have a list of seven different things here. And the first thing that just immediately popped into my head was the fact that Facebook ads don't feel like they're getting easier, better, or more lucrative in 2018. I really struggled to get something workable out of those this year, even with hints from Moitza and with the whole Cambridge Analytica thing blowing up and how they've changed the ads, what you can target, how you can target, how the pixel works, all of that stuff. Like there's just a whole layer of complexity on top of it now. And I don't feel it used to be there when I first did Facebook ads in like 2014, 2015. It's just, it's a mess now. It's a mess. And, you know, it's still cheaper than AdWords. So it's got that going for it. But if you're not as effective as you could be with AdWords, you know, I haven't heard anybody talking about, oh yeah, we do AdWords advertising these days. They're always mentioning Facebook or something else. But Facebook ads are tough. You know, I think that's one of my takeaways from 2018. They're tough and they suck.
I mean, I think I mentioned on maybe the last episode, if you don't know what you're doing, it is very dangerous. I mean, you can spend a ton of money and get no result. So we're doing a bit of paid ads for Castos, and actually they're paying off so far. So we'll have Moitz on in a couple of weeks to talk about what we're doing and how we can do it better. But if I was going to go to a social media platform to get business these days, I would go to LinkedIn. And not LinkedIn ads, but like LinkedIn cold outreach. And I don't think, Dave, it would really work for Recapture. It doesn't work for Castos, surely. Maybe it would work for something like Podcast Motor, and like a lot of agencies use it. I totally agree. Facebook ads is getting more difficult. I think you have to have a pretty big LTV to be able to pay for them and a bunch of other stuff in your funnel. Like just a Facebook ad to have people buy something is really tough these days.
Yeah, I mean, Facebook, it's a tough nut to crack just because the reason that people are on there is not the reason that your business necessarily wants them to be thinking about it at that time. Yeah. You know, they're looking at cat videos and listen to Aunt Ada bitch about Thanksgiving dinner last year and the fact that she's got to come to your house this year.
Yeah.
So that whole thing just is a difficult transition to go to a business mindset. And I heard from a guy at Big Snow Tiny Conf last year about how he sort of bridges that. And I didn't get to do that earlier in the year, and then I kind of lost my opportunity because the article I was toying with on that was very time sensitive, and then Shopify thing blew up in my face and GDPR and all that other stuff. So we never ended up getting... Yeah, then GDPR happened, and then, well, fuck me, so. All right, so what's your first one on your list?
So my first one is hiring lower-cost contractors almost always gets you what you pay for, which is not a great result. And this is not like earth-shattering news to anybody. I think we all, I certainly, try to look for like the diamond in the rough, like that person that you can get for $8 an hour that's going to do $50 an hour kind of work. And I think more and more the visibility and the transparency of places like Upwork or wherever make it to where these people know they should charge more. I think back in the day, a couple of years ago, you could find somebody for really cheap that could do really high quality work because there was just less velocity around these freelance marketplaces. And so they didn't know that they could charge more. But now the information is there from our perspective and from a freelancer's perspective to where like it's like an efficient market now, you know, like kind of economic thing, to where they know they do good work. People tell them they love their work, and so they'd raise their price until that evens out. And so I think that's kind of where we are in terms of like hiring freelancers, is you gotta pay for the quality of work that you're looking for these days.
Yeah. And I'd like to throw out a corollary on that one. Just because you found one or two on there doesn't mean that you can repeat that or scale it.
Totally.
Which was totally my mistake. Like, I scored a couple of great finds on there, guys that are working on the plugin, and I thought, oh man, there must be hundreds of them out there. And then I went to look for them on, for later jobs and other follow-on work, and I just never found anybody as good, as diligent, or at the same rate that I found these guys.
Yeah.
And it's just the way it is. You got to pay for it. I would even throw another corollary on top of all that. Just because you pay a good rate doesn't mean you're getting a good person either.
No, sure.
I tested some people that were, telling me that their billing rate was 50 to 75 up to 90 an hour. And they answered the questions just as badly as somebody who was down in the 20s and 30s.
Mm-hmm.
It has, the rate is not indicative of their quality necessarily, unfortunately.
Yep.
So that sucks.
So how about you for number two?
Well, I learned that opening a new channel takes way longer than you think it does. And no matter how much you expect it or think you've prepared for it or claim that you understand it, it still will take longer than you think. There's a law in software, and I'm trying to remember whose law it is, and it's going to come to me after the podcast, sadly. The law of estimates, and it basically, even if you take into account the fact that your estimates are going to be off and you try to increase it, you're still going to be off.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So it was the same thing here when I tried to open up Shopify. It didn't really start like hitting on all cylinders for me as a channel until pretty much 6 months later.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. So that sucks because I really needed that to happen sooner than it did. And it takes time. It takes time for people to know you and like you and trust you.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
I have one along those lines later. But my second one is scaling a SaaS application is a never ending process. And I think maybe for me as like a non-technical person, but probably even for like a generalist kind of front end developer or something like that, getting into scaling a SaaS app to hundreds and thousands of users is a really complex thing. We're seeing this with Castos now that we're not outgrowing AWS, but we're finding AWS is not exactly right for us in some ways. And even within AWS, we're kind of consistently bumping up against the way we had things set up to begin with. And so now we have load balancers and auto scaling and stuff. And now we have like different ways where we're kind of managing our database and things like that. And it's like, what I've learned is that it's a never ending process and we don't have a process for managing that. And that's what we need, is to be able to say, every week or every month or something, where are we across like the kind of six or eight pieces of technology that we use, our infrastructure? Where are they probably going to break next? Because they're going to break, or they're going to run up against the wall, you know? And how can we try and stay in front of that? Because I think surely from a user's perspective, it's a shit ton better for us to stay in front of that. But for me and like my blood pressure to stay in front of this and not get stressed the fuck out every, you know, 6 weeks or something when something's broken, is really important. So that's kind of like in terms of managing the technology, like I feel like our development team is really good. Our DevOps team is good. And it's just a matter of managing the DevOps process now is something that we're having to kind of put some forward-looking energy into.
Yeah. And since I didn't develop Recapture, I can't say like what the total mindset was, but I did ask the guy who originally wrote it, like how he kind of designed it for scaling. And he basically had a pretty good understanding of where the weak spots would be and the points of if I needed to like replicate something, where would I replicate it so that I could just have a bunch of things out there in parallel processing this data. And so even though he didn't like go to a great length to design the app for scaling per se, like he wasn't trying to make sure that it could do millions of requests right out of the gate. He just made it so that you could basically scale up another server identical to the one that you have mm-hmm. to double your processing capacity or triple, you know, depending on what your the machine. It's really machine dependent in many ways. So if I just put it on a bigger instance with more CPU and more network bandwidth, I get more stuff out of it. And that's pretty much what we had to do for scaling. So, you know, I would say if you're designing your app, like don't try to bulletproof it and scale it and make all this other stuff in there, but design it in a way that it becomes scalable when you want it to be scalable in a horizontal way. Because I think it's very easy these days to have, you know, DigitalOcean instances or AWS instances, or there's other, you know, competing out there, Azure instances. You can totally scale it that way just by throwing some servers at it for a while. And that gets you a lot farther than I think you think it will.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. Mm-hmm. No, totally. And that, you know, there's this Laravel specific article, but it doesn't have to be Laravel. We'll link to it in the show notes. It's basically, you know, the eight things you should do with your SaaS app before you write a line of code in terms of thinking about how it should be architected so that you can scale it on something like AWS. So we'll link to this in the show notes. But yeah, in terms of the kinds of things that the original Recapture developer did, we probably should have thought about a lot of these things, but I mean, we're all kind of learning as we go. So it's been a good lesson. So hopefully we save somebody some headache down the road there. Yeah. And so kind of along the same lines of something that I haven't done, but I want to, and I realize this is becoming kind of necessary for us and the team at Castos, is to ask our developers what they would like to specialize in. So we have two developers plus a DevOps guy now. Obviously the DevOps guy is kind of going to specialize in DevOps. But I think as people look to build teams, development teams of, you know, five plus people, you get out of being just generalists and you can ask people, say, hey, do you want to do front end? Do you want to do back end? Do you want to do UI? Do you want to do testing? You know, do you want to get into the DevOps kind of world? Because I find that if you don't ask, then people start doing a bunch of work that they don't want to do. And it kind of takes away from the happiness of your team. And so that's not, as someone who's not a developer, it's something that's never occurred to me because I just have to do everything that the business needs. But, you know, a technical person really wants to be challenged and fulfilled by the work that they do. And so it's on us as founders and like team leaders to say, what is that? And kind of let them run with it if they're kind of qualified and good at it.
Yeah, it's probably one of the core reasons I lost one of my WordPress developers last year after working with me for 5 years. You know, he just said, I'm ready to move on. And it was probably, you know, contingent on me not, you know, proactively asking him, what is it that you want to do? And then try to find a place where I can fit him in there, because I was just so focused on keeping the plugins up and running and moving forward and getting to the next version and doing all these major features and yada, yada, yada. I never stopped to ask him, what is it he wants?
Yeah.
So, yeah, definitely a problem. Definitely a problem. So my next one is kind of in line with my previous one. The integrations are not a guarantee and they can be dangerous to your business if you depend on them too much. So our integration with Shopify, it ended up going okay, but I kind of had this unrealistic expectation in retrospect that within 2, maybe 3 months, I just start to see a flood of customers in there. And it took us way longer to get it done. Like, we started in November, a year ago, basically, from now. And it wasn't ready until April. Mm. And that included, like, work that we ended up having to add in for GDPR as well, which caught us by surprise. And on top of all that, you know, just making it solid work and throwing it out there, like, it was crickets for a long time. It just did not have that market traction, even though I started doing some promotion and I went on a bunch of podcasts. I mean, it just takes a while for people to hear your name enough to go, oh, yeah, those guys. Or if they've mm-hmm. just been sitting in the app marketplace long enough, oh, yeah, those guys. And now my app is starting to kind of climb in the rankings on Shopify. So I'm in a decent spot now, where I'm getting more installs a day and I'm getting better installs now, but it didn't happen right away. And I really bet a lot of the farm on this earlier this year, and I was really unfocused on trying to get more Magento folks until pretty much August, when I saw that the Shopify was not banging down my door saying, hey, we're totally on board with this. But that was too late. Like, I should have had a better split plan earlier to say, I'm putting this integration out there, but I'm only depending on it for 25% for this long,
yeah,
or something like that. Yeah. I overweighted it, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that integrations are a great way to expand your market and marketing. But if I look at, like, the apps that have done really, really well with integrations, they're either the apps that you have to have an integration with to make it really valuable, or they've done integrations.
Zapier.
Yeah, Zapier. Well, or I don't know. Kind of like SalesCamp, right? Like, SalesCamp by itself is great, but it's really manual. When you hook it up to Stripe, it's like, wow, everything is automatic. You know, this is cool. So, like, I would put SalesCamp a bit in that. Like, we had to have Stripe integration for it to be valuable. Right. But yeah, Zapier, Stripe, kind of, I guess. Like, Stripe by itself doesn't really mean anything, but you integrate Stripe to your website and then you got something. So, yeah. So I think when these apps have kind of product market fit and traction and a marketing channel, then using an integration to grow and kind of branch off of that main marketing channel is where they're really, really kind of pour fire on the, pour gas on the fire. That's the term.
Or fire on the gas. That sounds like a really bass-ackwards way to do it. Right. It reminds me of a video I saw recently where a guy was pouring a little bit of gas on a campfire, and then it blew up. The fire blew up onto the gas can, and it's like burning the gas can. The guy panics, throws the gas can across his yard, and all of a sudden his bush in the backyard by the fence is now on fire. There's a stream of gas across the grass that's on fire. He's running away. It's like...
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. So this reminds me, a total tangent, but I just started following Hold My Beer on Twitter. I don't know, do you follow them?
I haven't, but I'm going to look them up after this.
We'll link to it in the show notes. But it's all these, like, memes and videos of, like, totally stupid stuff people are doing. It's like, hold my beer while I whatever. So yeah, check it out. It's a nice break, like, from all the depressing political stuff that's going on out there. So.
Yeah, sounds like my kind of humor.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. So my next one is good design and UI and UX can be a competitive advantage. I think it's kind of like the tale of two worlds that I live in. Is at Castos, we had focused on it from the very beginning, and Jane Portman did our kind of layout and design and UI, and we get compliments on it. People come to us, they say, wow, your stuff is really pretty. I love it. You know, I'm leaving this other person because their stuff is so ugly and I really love it and it's great. And then with SalesCamp, we have kind of not spent the energy to make it look great. I mean, it looks fine, but it could look a lot better. And we've just kind of been building features and spending our resources there. And just me mentally thinking about how I market it and push it, I'm much happier to sell Castos and have a bunch of, you know, have success and customers there because it's a nice looking app. And I think customers come in and feel better about it when it's a nice looking app. So I guess my lesson there is it has to look nice here in the end of 2018. It has to look nice and work. Just to have it work is not good enough anymore.
Yeah. Or I would say as a corollary to that, it can't look like hell because it reflects on, even though it may do exactly everything that you say it does and do it fairly well, there's a lack of trust on something that doesn't look good when it also functions good.
Yeah, that's exactly
it. Functions
that's,
well. Yeah, whatever. I be grammaring good. yeah. So I would say that the same thing is true of Recapture. Like I've had people come in and compliment me and say that our interface is better than XYZ competitor, or they really enjoyed using it because it was easy to navigate around and find stuff. And that's one thing that I'm kind of cognizant about as we add more stuff. Like I don't want to break that UX. And so I think at some point I probably have to engage somebody like Jane or Jane herself to come in and take a look at it and say, all right, here's how I would set this up to not break this process or further improve it to make it easier for people to go through.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. No, I agree. So my next one is another one of those growth hacks that I was trying here in 2018. So I tried to connect with a bunch of agencies when I was at Shopify Unite. And I was very successful in like going through and doing the networking thing and getting conversations started and getting people's contact information to follow up with them. And I probably had like 20 different freelancers and agencies, and I got like half of those on phone calls afterwards. And of those, I probably had half of those engage and say, yeah, we would totally sell your stuff. And I got so excited by that, thinking, oh, well, I finally found a channel that I could really push this down to. But when I got to the end, it was one of those, well, yeah, we'll sell it if it makes sense or if we have any clients or if we feel like it. Yeah, I mean, it didn't turn into like this amazing drop, you know, fire hose kind of channel. It was more like drip, drip, and it was all it's all long-term stuff. Like, you can push them to a certain point, but if they don't trust your solution or know your solution or have familiarity that your solution is going to solve the problem compared to some of your competitors that might be more well-known, they're probably not going to recommend you, even if you demo really well, even if you have a good call, even if you give them compelling reasons, you know, to stick with you as opposed to somebody else. That was my thing here. So either I suck as a salesperson, which I don't think is entirely true, given how far I got in that process. But at the same time, the agency affiliate model is not a silver bullet for growth. It wasn't for me. So yeah, it might be a longer term thing. And maybe after another Shopify Unite, maybe after another year that of them seeing my name out there, that they're realizing, oh, okay, well, this guy's not a flash in the pan. Maybe we can start recommending him now. Like you gotta build it with that in mind, I think, because it's definitely not a short-term growth hack.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which is what I wanted it to be, and it didn't turn out that way.
Yeah, yeah. I would think this could be a good growth channel for you still. I mean, I think about, you look at like Jordan with Carthook in similar kinds of worlds that you're operating in. Mm-hmm. It sounds like they do quite a bit with agencies and talk to agencies a lot and stuff like that. So I wouldn't give up on this because it would be.
Oh, no.
No. Yeah, no, man, I hear you. It's a long term, and you're basically selling like enterprise, right? In this respect, like that's kind of the analogy, is you're selling into another business.
Yeah, that's fairly close. Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll go with that.
Yeah. So, you know, I would wonder, like, even if you don't sell these people on things, is like your brand recognition and all of that kind of stuff increased because of being connected to those people in some way? So even if you don't sell them on something, they're not a reseller or an affiliate for you, can you work out something else that can help everybody out? So yeah, I hear you that this looks like a silver bullet, because I agree, but it's just tough, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and when they've got other problems and you're not one of the solutions to those problems, you're definitely not going to be top of mind for them.
Yeah.
So, you know, and several of them told me that. They're like, we are digging ourselves out of a hole because of all the Shopify changes over here, so we're revamping a bunch of stores. Their email marketing is not what we're working on right now. Like, we're building a bunch of other things for their stores and redoing their point of sale and updating the theme and the website at X, Y, and Z and all of these other things. And they're like, yeah, I mean, I would still be interested in doing your thing. It's just, that's not what we're doing right now. And mm-hmm. I'm swamped,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'm taking them at face value on this one. I talked to the guy and I don't think he's lying to me because of that. I believe that, you know, if you got five problems and they're all equally important, number one is going to be the one that you focus on the most. And until that one's done, you're not looking at 2, 3, 4, and 5. So,
yeah. Yeah. So my next one is a live chat on your website is not for bootstrappers. So I've gotten a lot of influence from my mastermind group to say, just use Help Scout. So I chose Help Scout for Castos. We moved over fully kind of earlier this week. And man, it has been totally transformational in the way that we deliver support. I think we deliver better support without chat. I enabled the chat thing for maybe like an hour a day. But it is amazing how much better the customers give us like the first piece of contact. They give us more information. They give us more context. They give us screenshots and links and stuff like that in the first piece of contact. And I think that's why then we're able to then answer their request or bug or whatever in like one piece of contact instead of like in chat. They would come in and say, my website's broken. And you're like, okay, what's your website? Why is it broken? What are you expecting to see that you're not seeing? But instead we're getting like, hey, this is a link. This is the code I'm using. This is what's working and this is what's not. Here's a screenshot. And so that's like everything that I need or my developers need to say, yep, that's a bug, or nope, this just, we're not using it right. And here's the documentation or whatever. So like, I loved the messaging capability of Intercom, and I still do. And I think, you know, free business idea for anybody. I think there's absolutely a way or a place for a standalone proactive messaging app to sit inside SaaS apps. So basically take the functionality of the Intercom messaging and like Autopilot HQ email does this. They call it heads up messaging, but just like little pop notifications that you can build into an app to where you don't have to build it in yourself, but just to use a little like API or something that can trigger on any page or with events or something. That's totally still needed. I really still miss that on Intercom because it helps us like onboard and train our customers that we don't get that with Help Scout. I think they're building it, but just for support, it should be ticket and email based. I think if you're a big, huge business or an e-commerce or something like that, where you have a whole bunch of people making purchasing decisions all the time, then maybe chat is important. But for us, we're turning around tickets and resolutions faster with tickets and email than we were with chat. So I'm sold.
Yeah, I like email chat too. The downside to that is that when you're sending out emails and you use the reply address to go back to support, then you still get those people that are like, my shit's broken.
Yeah.
But the thing that we did, and I don't remember if we did it like this year, I think we did it late last year, but it's been really helpful this year with my support person, Bobby, and we have a contact form, but this time I sort of stole this idea from Pippin from Easy Digital Downloads, where they collect a ton of information, and I make it contextual to say, if this is a billing question, like I don't need your license key, but if you're talking about general stuff or you're having a technical question, then you know I ask for license key and I ask for other stuff like versions of Business Directory and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So that has helped quite a bit because now we get like more of those kinds of things where people go to our contact form and spit those back to us. And you've got so much more to work with to solve it in that one shot. And that is hugely important. So it's more than just having email on your website with a contact form to say, here's your name, email address. Tell us in verbal diarrhea what you want.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you structure it and put some forms in there, but this help, you know, you have to understand what your support needs are to really get value out of that. So it's good on you for doing that because that makes a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, we've had like two customers come back and say, why did you get rid of live chat? And I can honestly come to them and say, now, look, hey, we're a week into this and already I promise you we have less open tickets at the end of a day or the week and we're getting people's problems fixed faster. And it's just up to the customers a little bit to give us everything at one time so that we can go and say, yep, this is a bug fixed, or this is the issue. Here's the resolution.
Yeah. So, customers not always right on that. They always, I get people that are asking us for phone support, but what they really want us to do is to do the work for them.
Yeah. They want it fixed.
They don't just want it fixed, but they want us to walk them through every little step. And yeah. I'm like, if you bought my highest end product here, I still don't do that for you. But if you're paying for a $70 WordPress module, I'm definitely not doing that for you. And if you haven't bought anything, you can just forget it altogether.
Yeah.
But I still get people that are asking about phone support, and we just will never do that because you will spend so much time taking people that are kind of in over their heads technically that just need to find a different avenue than what we have.
Like, yep.
That's not us. And I never want it to be us, and it will never be us. So, yes. So speaking about educating customers, one of the things I learned this year, when we pivoted in June to this notion of customer lifetime value, this was something that at first I thought, okay, well, surely more people in e-commerce must know about this, and all I have to do is just remind them. And then as I went on with this, I realized this was kind of a novel thing. Like, only those people that really deeply get their business and are growing in the 8 and 9 figure range have ever really looked at this stuff. And even then, it's not 100% like nailed even from their perspective. So when I started making Recapture more about that, I suddenly found myself having to educate customers about why they should care about this stuff and why it's important and what this will do for their business and why this is a growth lever that they're not really aware of, and how by paying attention to certain things that they can really increase their overall monthly revenue. Like, that was just not obvious to the merchants that I was talking to, and that was really surprising. And doing this right now is a hard thing. Like, it makes things a lot harder to sell because it's a problem that they don't yet know that they have, even though they really do have it. So your job now is to educate them about that problem, and then they have to agree that that's a problem. And even though you know it's important and how it will help them, if they don't get it, then they're not going to buy onto it. And that's a hard thing to do. It really is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm still trying to crack that nut. I'm not there yet. I mean, it's not 100% there, but we're on the way. So.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is one that's worth going after. And the person that this makes me think of is Patrick Campbell from Price Intelligently or Profit Well. He talks so much about all these like SaaS analytics and metrics and stuff like that. And a lot of business owners don't know that they have a problem of this or that, or that their business model sucks because of their pricing. And he is creating that problem and the solution. And I think that's, Dave, where you could really differentiate yourself from some of your competitors and say, like, your customers at some point will come and say, I know I have a customer lifetime value problem because Dave has been talking about how important it is all the time, and Recapture is the only tool that solves it or gives me data about it or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it could be a huge like differentiator.
Yeah. And that's certainly my goal here. And I'm trying to double down on that. But again, that education thing here, when the customers don't understand why that's a big deal,
yeah,
that means you got to really double down on content marketing to do that. And I started to do that in September, but I'm not paying for content marketing right now. I can't afford a full-time content marketing person as much as I would like to have that. So, I wrote a 2,000-word article on customer lifetime value and why it should be your North Star metric. And I put in a whole bunch of stuff, and I, synthesized a bunch of other articles that I found, and I threw it out there, and it just didn't have the reception that I expected it to. And that's when I realized that, they don't really get why this is a big deal. And that's why I wrote the article, and I'm continuing to promote that. But then Black Friday hit, and now nobody's really paying attention. So mm-hmm. You got to focus on Black Friday by the time you get to October. So
yeah.
There's nothing else.
So my next one is totally obvious, but I have a bit of an addition that maybe makes it a little less obvious, but the kind of headline is going into a market that you don't know a ton about is really dangerous. And this
ding, 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 ding,
Captain Obvious over here.
Yeah.
No, and this is where we are with Sales Camp a little bit. I mean, obviously I've been an affiliate. We have affiliates. Everyone knows what an affiliate is, but I think where you run into trouble with this is when you have to rely on customer feedback for the direction of your product. And I saw this conversation with somebody on Twitter the other day. That was basically like, if you have to rely on what your customers say to know what your product should be, you're in trouble. And it's kind of contrary to the, like, just listen to your customers, new customer development, all that kind of stuff. But like, the customers don't always know exactly what you should build. They know what they want, but they don't know what you should build. And we've found ourselves chasing our tail a lot with Sales Camp and like building stuff that one person wants because we just wanted that customer, and then no one else wants it. And then like go build another thing because this other person wants it. And so like we're getting to the point now where we have like a really complete app. But we've built a lot of stuff that nobody cares about too. It's the only point that I have like regret about. I mean, it's definitely been a learning lesson and I will never do it again, blah, blah, blah. But like, I've spent a lot of time and money doing stuff that's not really necessary in the grand scheme of things. Yeah, we wouldn't get that one customer, but maybe we'd get a whole bunch more if we didn't spend that time and money on building this thing that somebody said they needed. So, and it's just a matter of not really knowing, like, yeah, that's an edge case. And I'm sorry, we're not going to build that because I just don't know the market and what people use these tools for.
Yeah. I would say the plugin suffered from that for a number of years, at least the first two on each, because I didn't know how they were used all that well. And people would just come in and ask for features. And originally I did exactly what you did. It was the knee jerk. Yeah, sure. I'll throw that in the product. And then after a while I was like, nobody else is asking for that. And then I got into the habit of just starting to say no, or we'll consider it. And then I would like base it on frequency. So if I had like five people ask me for a similar kind of thing, then I was like, oh, that's important. We can put that in.
Yeah.
But it took a while. And then you realize after a while, when you've been doing it for a few years, like when somebody gives you a request, you can tell the really esoteric shit from the stuff that's pretty core. But it's not something that's obvious right away. So like when you jump into that new market, you think everything's important because somebody's talking about it. And if you go on that customer feedback thing, you say, oh, well, they're asking for it, I should put it in. And that's not always true, but it takes a while to kind of gain that judgment, to have enough experience to know which is bullshit and which is core. Mm-hmm. And I'm getting to that point now with e-commerce, but when I first started with Recapture, I would have just thrown anything in that I possibly could have if I had had the resources to, no doubt.
Yep.
So my next one here is actually sort of a positive one. The thing that I learned this year in putting both of the plugin businesses kind of in the background, I'm not really actively trying to manage them or do tons and tons of like new development. We're finishing up stuff in AWPCP that's been in there for a while, but that's mostly autopilot from that one guy. And then my other guy, he's got some features, but these things have been queued up for a long time. It's not like I was really having to think about or prioritize this stuff. And once he got up to speed, I just kind of let him go and said, here's what you need to work on for this, and here's what you need to work on when you're not doing support. And aside from those, I'm spending like an hour or two a week in tier three support, and that's it.
Wow.
And this low input business is generating me a fairly decent amount of cash flow at this point, even after considering how much it costs to have the three people that are working on it work on it. Well, four actually, because I forgot the guy that does the forum work support. So I got four other people working on it, and I'm not putting in tons of effort into it, and I'm still getting a pretty decent cash flow out of it. So a good business doesn't have to be a business that you want to sell.
Yeah.
You know? This thing's throwing out cash, and I kind of like not having to spend tons and tons of time on it to make it do that. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I think there's, my friend Brian said there's a lot of hand-wringing around bootstrapping these days. But I think that like having something that makes money so you can go do something else is the best way to bootstrap a SaaS business, whether it's WordPress plugins that you don't have to do anything with and they just make, you know, money kind of passively, or a productized service or consulting or whatever. Bootstrapping and self-funding is totally doable if you have something like this. Yeah, I totally agree, Dave. And this kind of dovetails into my next point, which is all great businesses and business models don't have to be SaaS. I mean, we live in a SaaS heavy world or whatever. Like this podcast is a lot about SaaS, and a lot of people listen to this or into SaaS and all that kind of stuff. But to this day, Podcast Motor is my best business. And it is not a SaaS business. It is a productized service, and it is kind of a complicated and involved productized service, you know, like, but it makes really good money, profit wise, you know, not just revenue. And I think people who are just starting out and say like, I want to build the next Drip or Cart Hook or Recapture or whatever, you really should think about, I think, like what your goal is. Like, if you want a good lifestyle business, it's not SaaS. If you want to really like hit a home run, maybe like that's maybe the only way to make a bunch of money. But if you want a good lifestyle business, you know, productized business, productized service, consultant, something like a WordPress plugin, one-time sale, selling courses, is by far a better business model than SaaS. Because what I'm seeing is that to make SaaS a really good business, you got to have like pretty decent scale, unless you're a developer and you can do everything yourself, at which point you just have like a nice job, which is not really any different. So,
yeah, but at least it's a job you can get laid off from, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But, yeah, I hear you. And SaaS is hard in 2018. Like, you're not just going to grind together a SaaS in a month and throw it up there and everybody's going to come flocking to you like they were 6-7 years ago. It's just a very different world today in that regard. And the competition is fierce. And yeah, there's a lot of non-SaaS business models that are still totally viable and worth pursuing. Definitely. I would agree. Mm-hmm. So my last one here has to do with the plugins again. And that is, solid WordPress developers are not easy to find. And it's only gotten harder over the last 6 years, I'm afraid. You know, like I was saying earlier, I really lucked out in the first two guys that I found, and they were able to champion things for a long time. And then when my guy left last year, I had to replace, and I went through several candidates, and most of them were pretty mediocre. And the guy that I ended up picking, he's pretty good, but, you know, he's not at the same level as the guys that he replaced. So it took a while for him to kind of grow into the position. And now I'm looking for somebody else to add on to that, to do some sort of contract level work, to get some one-off things done where he just is bandwidth limited, doing support and other things. And I want somebody else to lean on for those one-time kind of projects. And I've engaged like a couple of different headhunting agencies to find somebody that's out there, and I couldn't find them. I've gone through Upwork, still a lot of mediocrity on there. It's tough. It's really tough to find a solid WordPress developer these days. So if you're looking to specialize in something, WordPress wouldn't necessarily be a bad choice. I know everybody's like hating on WordPress, but man, we're hating on Java for years, and right now Java developers make some pretty good coin because the ones that have the money to hire them are paying top dollar for it because they want somebody that actually knows what the hell they're doing. And I'd say the same is true of WordPress right now.
Yeah, no, especially in the next few months with Gutenberg. I mean, it's going to be, we're not going to get into a Gutenberg rant, but it's going to change.
Yeah, it's going to change, but yeah. It's interesting. We could do a whole podcast on that, and maybe we will sometime, but not now. Yeah. All right, we'll leave Guten Turd alone here.
my last one is also positive and contrary, which is that B2B and SaaS is not the only way to go. That B2C or B2Prosumer is a huge and growing area of the SaaS market. So you know, Castos is definitely not a B2B app. But it still is a perfectly good business that we run. And there are a lot of people out there that have huge businesses that are really B2B. I mean, like Buffer, right? And I would argue even like Drip or ConvertKit are B2B-ish, but there's a lot of people that don't make any money that pay a bunch of money to Drip every month.
And they absolutely do.
And so I think that like this is good because very few of us have like business knowledge in another industry that we would build a SaaS for. So like our friend Brian Marble builds tools for lawyers, right? Because his wife's an attorney and so he knows the market really well. The guys that do MoraWare with countertop estimating software. That's like a cool example of like really technical guys that know another totally unrelated market and can build something there. And there's probably like less competition and stuff like that from within our world. But for everyone else, like, yeah, go build a tool for WordPress because you know a ton of people that build WordPress products. Or go build a podcast. Don't go build a podcast hosting platform because you know a bunch of podcasters. But I think... like if it's what you know really well, that's a lot better than saying, oh, it has to be B2B. So I'm going to go learn about gyms and build a SaaS app for gyms because you're going to get your ass handed to you. Go build something for people that you know. And if it's B2B, that's great. If it's B2C or B2 prosumer or B2 entrepreneur or whatever, that's cool. You can make a shit ton of money and be successful and have a great lifestyle business there too. I don't know. That's what we've seen at least.
Yeah. Along those same lines, I've noticed like a lot of the businesses that I take my kids to, I'm always kind of curious to see what software they're using to manage things. And a lot of the stuff that they're using just, it looks like it's got a shitty UX. It looks like it was written in ASP.NET circa 2005. And sometimes it is. And it's just an utter disaster. Like they're adding on things like a mobile app and you can tell it's a bolt-on kind of thing here. Like they got some outsourced team halfway across the world to create it and it's kind of flaky and it's not very, doesn't look very nice and it doesn't have the same experience. And so there's plenty of places that if you're paying attention, you can see where those niches exist and where they're underserved. And those places might be exactly where you need to find that business idea because you've got direct connection to a human being that you can actually talk to, which is so important.
Yep. I would put local businesses in the same realm that we're talking about. Building a business based on a local market might be an interesting way that's like to have almost no competition, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyways, just thinking outside the box a little bit that don't think you have to do what everyone else is doing. So, yeah. So I hope everybody enjoyed kind of Dave and I chatting through, you know, reflecting a little bit on what we've kind of seen and learned in 2018. We'll probably do an end of the year episode here at the end of the year. We got another 5 or 6 weeks until then. But yeah, if anybody has stuff they'd like to share with everybody, drop a comment in below the show notes for this episode or shoot us a message, podcast@roguestartups.com. And if you'd like us to share your kind of learnings on the next episode, we certainly would. Thanks so much, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Rogue Startups. If you haven't already, head over to iTunes and leave a rating and review for the show. For show notes from each episode and a few extra resources to help you along your journey, head over to roguestartups.com to learn more.